Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast for the week of July 26, 2021. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at UT Austin. I'm happy to have back on the show today our friend Jonathan Tylove. Jonathan was a longtime political writer for the Austin American Statesman, based in Austin at the time. He has now moved back to Washington, D.C., where he had previously resided in an earlier phase of his career. He's been freelancing there, including several pieces in the last several months for Texas Monthly. Among the pieces he's written for Texas Monthly, by the way, is a great profile of former Senator Huff Hines, who is challenging Greg Abbott for the GOP primary. So I urge you to check that out, easily found using Google. And if you're not a Texas Monthly subscriber, I think you get three freebies. So you can read Jonathan's story on Don Huffines and then go read a good restaurant review or something. So Jonathan, you've been back in DC and you've been keeping an eye on Texas politics through the prism of Washington. Josh Blank and I were laughing when the Texas House Democrats broke quorum and headed for Washington, DC. It was like, you left Texas and the politics came to you.
Yeah, it's a complete gift. It's really this may be a mixed blessing for, you know, the Democrats, the Republicans, for Texas, but for me it's all good. And I got so confused when they, you know, it was a Monday, I think, when they said they were going to break quorum and head to Washington. And for some reason I assumed like it was going to be the next Monday or something. I don't know why, but the point was that night I was at Dulles Airport to greet them, and have been spending most of my time back and forth to the hotel where they're staying or wherever they happen to be every day.
I have to give my wife, Kathy Grant, credit, who saw you in a picture on Twitter.
Yeah.
That somebody else had thought you were kind of in the background. I don't know. I don't think you had even posted it. I think it was somebody else.
No, I didn't. No, no.
And she was like, look, it's Jonathan. He's there.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm very happy. And I mean, the virtue pre-COVID of covering the Texas legislature, well, the House especially compared to Congress, was they're right there. You know, you could talk to them. They were accessible. That kind of went away with COVID. But here they're even more accessible because
you
know, I have a couch that I basically sit on in the lobby, and you know, they can't come or go without me having a shot at them. So it's great.
Well, so let's, you know, you've obviously been in touch with at least several of the Democrats. So like, you know, I want to game this out, but I really do want to get a sense of like, what's the mood among them as you're talking to them? Give me a sense of what the situation on the ground is like with the Democrats that have left, the House Democrats that have left Texas and are now, I don't want to say holed up because they seem reasonably active, but what's the day-to-day like for them? What's the situation?
Well, I think they're doing fine. I mean, I think that this is a kind of unifying experience for them. I think, you know, I'm sure it gets to be a bit much after a time, and I think they have to kind of maintain message discipline and talk about the same things over and over again. So it's got to be a little bit tiresome because they all are delivering essentially the same message. But I think, you know, considering they've dealt with COVID and they've dealt with a lot of hostile, you know, reaction from Republicans back home and the threat of this and that, and, you know, maybe losing chairmanships or other perks, I think they're doing pretty well. And I think, you know, Phil Cortez was the one member who went back to the legislature, and he was there about a day, and then he came back. So he's for them the prodigal son. So I don't get any sense that they're fraying around the edges, or that you know, they feel less like this was a good idea or less purposeful about what they're doing.
You know, I was going to ask you about Representative Cortez. So for those who haven't followed it, Representative Cortez came to Austin ostensibly to negotiate with the Republicans and then left, and, you know, with the opprobrium and the issuing of a civil arrest warrant by the Speaker, which I think is, you know, as symbolic as anything, unless they, you know, arrest him when he comes back. But, you know, was that disruptive? Some of the reporting was that he was off the reservation and doing that. Is that correct?
If he was on my understanding, I haven't had a chance to talk to him yet, but my sense is that if he were, he said, I think, or he was quoted as saying that he was back there sort of on a mission to kind of see, to feel things out and see if there were possibilities for negotiation. And if he was on that kind of mission, it was, sotto voce. I mean, it was not something that was authorized by the caucus. And he got some pushback immediately saying, no, you're not doing this for us. And then he came back and, got a much harsher reaction from the Speaker, who said, you've lost our trust, and issuing the arrest warrant. So I don't know. It wasn't as if people were sitting around, at least in that I could hear, bitterly accusing him of betrayal, but certainly that was considered another kind of negative story of the day. Where is it going to come apart? And no, I think it was much more a one-off. And I'm not exactly sure. You know, my sense for Cortez is he probably comes from a district where he feels pretty secure. But one member told me he left with his on November and he came back with his eyes on March. So, you know, it may be that there was a sense that he was getting blowback for his decision, but it wasn't as if I did not see that as sort of the dam breaking and something bigger happening. I think it really was just a exception.
You know, that I was, you know, I mean, you sort of answered this, but I'm interested to hear you say that it seems like the level of coordination and solidarity is holding up. That was always one of the questions about this strategy, that when you get, 50 plus people, let alone, not to lapse too far into the conventional wisdom or stereotypes, but especially Democrats, that it's hard to keep them all on the same page. So you do sense a sense of solidarity and it's that it's hanging together.
Yeah. Yeah. Because they all have, I mean, I think their self-interest is all conjoined. I mean, I think that they're trying to explain why they would take the exceptional action of busting a quorum. And I think that there really is solidarity in the sense that they were about to be done in again in a way that wasn't going to listen to them or respect their views or the views of those who had problems with that legislation, and that they just weren't going to be party to it. And then I think the coincidence, I mean, I think there was some debate about where to go, but I think Washington made sense. And I think the coincidence of timing of Congress looking at the prospect of voting rights legislation simultaneous with this, the run of this special session, meant that it all kind of fit as a, okay, this is what we were doing, two things. We're trying to spoil this legislation and disrupt this session, but we're also appealing to the only place that they think they can get justice, which is from Washington, because they acknowledge that this legislation will pass at some point. They're not going to be able to push this, much further. So they are going to get a bill they don't like one way or the other. I think there is some sense that maybe they've called enough attention to a few things that maybe on going back, there will be some adjustment. I mean, there was some adjustment between the bill they killed the last session and the one that was presented in the special, with, discarding some of the things that Republicans said they didn't even know were in there.
Yeah, they discarded them in a way. Yeah, I mean, basically two of those, there were a couple of provisions that, Republicans all kind of were pointing at the other guy saying, people were either saying, we don't know where these came from, or, the Senate, Dan Patrick basically said they came from the House. The House, members of the House then said, well, the Senate bill author seemed to be comfortable enough defending them on the floor.
yeah, I mean, I talked to, you know, Carl Sherman, a rep from Dallas, and he said they still are waiting for their thank you for having killed a bill that would have had things in it that they acknowledge shouldn't have been in there.
Something tells me the thank you notes are not in the mail.
Right.
So, you know, you mentioned that the timing seemed fortuitous because they were talking about voting legislation, but, you know, my read is that that voting legislation, while it's very important to some, you know, it's very important to Democrats generally in Washington, D.C., but there are a lot of things in the queue in front of it and the clock ticking. I mean, you're there. I mean, is, you know, what are the prospects of them, of, you know, basically the Texas Democrats being bailed out by legislation in Washington that would supersede or you know, make more difficult at the very least state level legislation?
I think it's the odds on that happening are extraordinarily long. But I think in some sense, and this may sound, you know, ridiculous for people elected every 2 years, it's a play for history. This will be something that they will recall and remember, but it's also something where I think, you know, this could be a very small window for Biden to get done what he wants to get done. It seems, you know, more than likely that the House and Senate will both be Republican, and that this is, you know, his time to accomplish what he needs to accomplish. And I think they are attempting, along with sort of the activist community in some quarters, to make the point that the voting rights legislation is the most fundamental, that even more important to his Biden's legacy than infrastructure is this. And I guess, you know, the possibility of some kind of bargain being struck, I don't know. I think it's very unlikely. At the same time, I don't think it's absolutely out of the question. And I also think that their choices were to come here and at least, you know, stand for something or just get rolled over again. And I don't think that they're going to be regretting having made that choice, though. If they come back without having won any victory here and then end up getting, you know, all kinds of punitive measures when they get home and maybe a bill that's bad or worse than what they left, that maybe they'll be judged as having squandered a moment. But I don't know. I think this is, at least right now, it looks like there's a rationale for what they did, and that, you know, I can't really fault people for wanting to make a stand.
Well, you know, I'm not trying to fault anybody, but I mean, yeah. I do wonder, I mean, how they envision the practical end game here. Because it seems to me that there's, you know, you're probably not going to get either one of these voting bills that are at the national level, you know, in the next couple of weeks. Mm-hmm. You know, when the clock runs out on the session and they have to decide that they're coming back. And, you know, in other words, you know, have you talked to them about how they game out the end, get anybody? I mean, some of them, most of them must have at least thought about what the end game looks like here.
Yeah, but I think they're not ready to say it can't happen because...
Well, they can't say that publicly, but I'm...
Right. You know. Well, no, I'm not, but I'm not getting... At least in my conversations with people, I'm not getting the sense that they are come to terms with the idea that it just absolutely can't happen. I do think what changed in the last week or so was that they expressed their frustration with not being able to see Biden. And I think they were redirecting their, you know, he becomes sort of a target of their energy because it's like, come on, man. We're here. We're a gift. We're a gift, not just to me. We're a gift to you.
That was a good Biden. Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm not being facetious. No. You know?
Come on, man.
So, you know, I think that they're trying to square, you know, when they got here, he gave his speech on voting rights, and I don't know. He described it as a, you know, historic crisis, something, you know, not since the Civil War or something like this. And he says, Jim Crow on steroids. But what I'm saying is his rhetoric probably exceeds theirs, but he's not doing what it would take. And right. So I think,
rhetoric. He has presumably maybe a little more than that.
Right. And that's what they're trying to leverage or to make him feel like he needs to exercise. I mean, I guess I agree. It seems unlikely, but it also seems unlikely to me that Biden can just let this go because, I mean, you know, Clyburn was making the same case the Texas Democrats were and Manchin, that they should have a carve out, that they should at least get the, the preclearance for all states. So I don't know that. I don't know that he can just say, we didn't get to that. Yeah. I think he's in a bit of a bind on this. And I do think that the other context is that I think that if it were not for Trump, there's real fears that the next election could be a mess and that Trump could be on the ballot and that Trump could be the next president with a, this is not.
You mean the next presidential election? I mean, yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'm saying that.
Or.
I think that if Trump returns to the White House and it turns out that there were disputed elections in states where, you know, this made a difference, they're going to look like they should have been listened to.
Right. And so, you know, you were talking about the Democrats thinking about their legacy. There's an argument for Biden should be doing the same, which I think the Democrats are making. You know, I'm wondering if the compromise here, if there is a compromise, is that they pass the John Lewis Civil Rights Act, which would at least, you know, reestablish some of the judicial challenges to some of these laws. But I also don't know if it's too late for a compromise like that.
I don't know. I mean, I think if they got something that had the Justice Department having to review these changes and that's all they got, they would be thrilled. And the Texas Democrats are, you know, they're not arguing, you know, they say, oh, we'd like that other thing, but it's pie in the sky. It's not even what we're talking about. They have very, they have more realistic sense of what's possible and what their objectives are. So, you know, when they go see Manchin, it's not to beat him up. It's to kind of say, you know, we just want the protections that you in West Virginia have. We want to bring our voting standards up to West Virginia standards. We're not trying to
a sentence one might have thought never to ever hear.
Right, right. So I think that, you know, I think they're not absolutists or purists at all. I think their standards for what would be helpful or a victory are relatively modest, but they are important. And I think that's, you know, I don't know enough to know how that's all going to play out, but I just don't think that, Biden's been at this, you know, a long
Six
time.
Oh.
Yeah. No. I mean, what I'm saying is, I don't
how
think
playing,
that,
as somebody
how
who's playing
this,
the game.
I don't know. I don't know that he's just gone. I wish these people would shut up. I'm not really interested in this. This is a bridge too far, and all I care about is bridges.
Yeah, so, I don't think that's the case either.
Right, right. So
but
I
he does
I guess,
have a sequence in mind. To me, it's an interesting question. I think maybe this is where you're going, that, you know, is Biden or Klain or whoever you want to, you know, is the Biden team using the Texas Democrats, and I don't mean that in a pejorative way, but using their presence strategically, even if he's not giving them a lot of public love and Richard Raymond's getting frustrated.
Well, yeah, and I don't, I mean, the thing is that they arrived the day before his speech in Philadelphia. To me, the logical thing for him to have done would have been to invite Sinfonia Thompson to be next to him on that stage or some Texas Democrats. He obviously didn't strategize that, this is perfect. This will really help us make the case. Now, I don't know whether he didn't want to raise expectations or it's just too much too soon, or he didn't know who these people were and whether they'd behave properly. I don't know what the sequence was there, but you know, I mean, they're having, I mean, Sinfonia Thompson and Diego Bernal and Nicole Collier are testifying before a House subcommittee that's doing a hearing on voting rights in Texas on Thursday. So, I mean, it's not as if they're getting no acknowledgement here, or it's just, I think they've, you know,
they're in the mix.
They're in the mix. And for most of these members, this is more sustained, you know, cable time than they've had in their careers, because, you know, these are people who are usually more local market and they're not going to be on national television.
Yeah, no, I mean, MSNBC was the Texas House Democrat channel for a few days.
Right, right, right. And so I think that that's, you know,
Why not?
And again, it's if they're making the same claim in Texas, I think when you have a fresh audience, or people seeing people for the first time, or hearing people, or just, you know, that's different than, I think at some point in the Texas, the noise in Texas, you know, people go, oh, okay.
Yeah,
there they go again, and you know, they don't, it doesn't lift them up, and you know, I mean, whether however meaningful it is not, if it's always nice to be called a hero by everyone you encounter at your various press conferences and other appearances. So you know,
speaking of the noise in Texas, one of the things, and this is, you know, probably, you know, my perspective and subjective position here in the state, but you know, one of the things that's really, you know, coming up a lot in, you know, within a two mile radius of the Capitol downtown is the clock ticking on the legislative appropriation, you know, which really affects staff pay. Are you hearing any sense that that is affecting their strategizing at all? Or is it all like, are they all like at this higher level that we're talking about now? And that's kind of not something you're hearing about.
Well, yes and no. I mean, I guess, and I don't know, you know, they're waiting to see if the court does anything. But beyond that, I think, you know, they're not the only ones who are going to suffer from this. And I guess what I don't know is whether, I mean, a counter argument would have been they should have stayed there and have it the burden on Abbott to explain what was about to happen. I don't know. I mean, it does seem, I don't know. I mean, I think that there's a sense that this is a disaster, but it's not a disaster that's really of their making. So I don't think that they're feeling like, oh, but for us, this wouldn't have happened. I think they're feeling this was an outrageous, you know, kind of violation of separation.
Right.
And that this is Greg Abbott's creation.
Whoever created it, there are a lot of staff members that are, you know, worried about their paychecks, you know, soon.
Yeah.
Right. So I was wondering how much that was in the mix, but I mean, I guess there's some sense to that. I can't let you leave, and there's a connection here, however tenuous, without broaching a topic that of all the things that you and I have talked about over the years, we might've talked about the most. Mm. So Beto O'Rourke kicked in several $100,000, I guess, to help support the Democrats. Is he going to run for governor?
I think he probably is. I think he's created a situation. I mean, I don't create a situation. I think he's in a situation now where he has made the case that this is monumentally important, what's happening now. And he's been doing the kind of things, though not as a candidate, but as someone on these issues who's been, talking to people and raising money and making contacts. And I think that if he were not to do it at this point, there's no nobody waiting in the wings. There's nobody even, it's even hard to just conjure up a speculative list of who else would run. And so, it's not as if everyone's necessarily waiting, with bated breath, but I think also there's a sense that
If not him, who?
And that the Democratic Party won't be taken seriously if, after all, this furor about how horrible the things are that are happening to strip away people's rights, if they don't have a viable candidate for governor. And I think, you know, I think at this point, I mean, obviously, a candidate doesn't like to lose more than once. But I think at this point, I think Beto could justify this as I mean, he wouldn't say it this way, but even if I'm not going to be, even if I don't have a really good or realistic chance of winning, someone needs to be there to maintain the members, you know, down ballot, to help the congressional candidates, to help the state house candidates, and that he is, he's good at that. I mean, he is, that's what he does. And he derives energy from it. So, I mean, when he spoke to them, you know, he's good at what he does. And I think that, it would be hard. I think there, at this point, there would be, a real sense of, well, come on, man, again, if you had been more declarative, we might've done something about it, even though I don't see who or how or where they would have found somebody.
It's kind of, you know, it seems to me to be kind of a tough spot for him.
Yeah.
Because the odds are pretty long.
Yeah.
Given, you know, the fundamentals of the situation. And, you know, he's now waited a while, and it feels like, well, he's, you know, it feels a little to me like he was waiting for somebody else to step up, and there's nobody else there.
No, yeah. I think that's right. I just, he's, you know, about a narrative, and I think he's created the narrative that this is this struggle against Trumpism and against these attacks on rights. And I think that it combines sort of a political campaign with the movement. And I think that suits his, you know, personality. So I think I would be surprised at this point if he doesn't do it. The thing is, right now, Greg Abbott operates as if the general election is meaningless. I mean, there's nothing to worry about there. There's not even the necessity of making kind of token gestures in the direction of a general election. His entire orientation is toward the primary and toward his base. And so, you know, I think that whatever else, I mean, I think they would sort of think, oh, Beto is the ideal candidate to run against. But the ideal candidate to run against was Lupe Valdez, and they've already done that. So this Beto is a more serious threat, not only because of his talents, but also because he still will be able to raise money. He still will be able to run a reasonably viable campaign.
Well, and he would, I said this to somebody in a conversation yesterday, and I was going to go look it up, and I still haven't. So I'm going to say it now in a recording and hope I'm not wrong. But okay. I mean, I think he would be the first candidate at the top of the ticket to run with statewide campaign experience since Ann Richards. And that's worth a lot in Texas.
It's worth a lot. And I think that, I think that's right. And I think, you know, once he gets past the fact, well, okay, he lost for this, and then he lost for that. Once he gets past, if he can, you know, lose this one and do respectably well, there's Ted Cruz is ripe. Yeah. And I think
for a rematch that a lot of people would be very happy to see.
Very happy to see, and that might be, a somewhat better year.
Ultimately, his destiny.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Cruz is working every day to make that a viable option. I mean, you know, he's when he said that they could be put in, what was it, leg irons?
Yeah, I think that's right.
Yeah, so I mean, you know, that's he's not about kind of tamping down the emotions. He's ready to, yeah.
Well, so. I think it's appropriate we met on the, do you miss Texas? I know you went to DC for a reason and that there are good things there. You miss us at all?
I do. So this is why this is such a great blessing. And I, you know, I miss the weather in Texas because it's the heat here is unbearable.
Speaking of other things that people have never said.
No, I'm serious that I believe this when I was in Texas and I believe it when I'm back here. Maybe it's because I'm biking uphill to get home from these things, but this heat is even when it's 20 degrees less, it's worse here. And I'm sure it's not worse than Houston because I'm sure it's comparable to Houston, but I found the Texas heat much more bearable, the Austin, Texas heat.
Well, you know, I think if we didn't have enough reasons already, that certainly makes you an honorary Texan to stick up for the weather in Texas. Congratulations. Jonathan, thank you for being here. I really appreciate you taking the time and sharing this with us. Thanks to our crew in the Liberal Arts Development Studio in the College of Liberal Arts at UT Austin. Thanks to you for listening. And thanks again for Jonathan. It's good to be in touch. And we will be back next week. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.